have noticed, it's not the normal dialect theme, the old shoestring theme from the BBC series this week. This is Picking the Blues by Grinder Switch, which is the John Peel theme. The reason for that is because I like to do some sort of John Peel program on here at least once a year. This year it was impossible to actually get a slot specifically on John Peel Day, which is the 11th of October, and I was due to do something on the Cyrus the Virus program, but I couldn't play any John Peel songs on there. So today we're going to be playing a few on our show here. But that doesn't mean to say we're not going to be doing the usual news review as well. Joining me is Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Tony.
What are your thoughts about John Peel? Did you ever listen to him or not?
I listened to him a fair few times. The man with the legend.
A legend, indeed. The BBC, of course, haven't really replaced him, apart from they've got his son on, Six Music, Tom Ravenscroft. Did you ever listen to Six Music?
Regrettably not. Most time I listen to the radio is when I'm being driven somewhere, and my father prefers radios 3 and 4.
Okay. Well, anyway, this week we're going to be looking at John F. Kennedy assassination as well, because in roughly 1 month's time, we've got the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the US President John F. Kennedy. Rather than wait until the actual assassination date, I thought we'd jump the gun a little bit and also make sure that people are prepared for the nonsense that's going to be on the mainstream press about all this, and actually get to the heart of the matter, find out who really killed JFK this week. But Jason, it's a bit of an awkward question maybe, but do you know the connection between John Peel and the JFK assassination?
No, do tell.
Well, find out in more. Fact, the picture of the press conference that the Dallas police held at the time of the JFK assassination has got a certain person in the picture.
Would that be John Peel?
John Peel, who happened to be in Dallas at the time, and he sneaked into the press conference lying to the Dallas police, saying that he was a correspondent from the Liverpool Echo, and so they let him in.
There's actually a picture done. In there.
And John's verdict on it all was very, very simple. The guy was a patsy, Lee Harvey Oswald, and of course he was shot by a member of the mob, Jack Ruby. Who was then himself killed in order to completely cover that trail of evidence, at least supposedly. So anyway, let's get cracking with a little bit of discussion about JFK. I mean, what are your understandings about who he was? I mean, he was killed on the 22nd of November, 1963. Very earth-shattering, really. A lot of people felt very sad and sorry that it had happened. But what's your understanding, Jason, of who JFK was and what he represented?
JFK was a Democratic president of the United States. He represented a lot of closing down things like the mafia linked to Cuba, and a lot of that sort of represented closing down a lot of the dirty side, if you will, of the mafia. Well, the mafia is almost a bit dirty side, but you're certainly cracking down on the mob.
Well, that's true. He also was basically closing down the Cold War. That was another thing.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted the Cold War over and done with, pretty much.
Yeah, and he wanted to also completely stop any kind of invasion of Vietnam, these kind of things. But, I mean, I don't want to dwell too much on it because, I mean, you could, if you spend just a little bit of time investigating this for yourselves, folks, it doesn't take long to realise what happened. But the thing is, the real evidence is, the best evidence has been presented by New Orleans District Attorney, who did a very deep investigation into the Kennedy assassination several years after it happened. The Warren Commission was set up, and there were several people on that Warren Commission who actually were Kennedy's opponents politically. So quite obviously there are motives to cover up the proper investigation of the Kennedy assassination. What do you think? What's your, just before we hear from Jim Garrison, who's the district attorney from New Orleans, Jason, what are your thoughts about, you know, what might, motives might have been, etc.?
Well, there are many motives, Tony. I mean, there's some suggest it was the mob trying to whack JFK for closing down a lot of their outlets, particularly in Cuba. Some suggest it was the Cubans or the Russians, and some suggest it was the CIA.
Okay, well, Jim Garrison, he was a former soldier, and the other thing is, it's very important to understand that Dwight Eisenhower did warn, didn't he? He said, well, you know, if you're not a former soldier, you need to be very careful as a US president because the military will pull the wool over your eyes. And of course, in subsequent presidents, that proved to be true, where you know, they were told various things which weren't true. But Kennedy was involved in a family that had been in the military. His brother died in the Second World War, for example. So anyway, let's go and have a listen now to Jim Garrison. Jim Garrison wrote a book called On the Trail of the Assassins. Although the prosecution that he did in New Orleans didn't actually finally come to anything, he believes, and certainly I would say I believe, he came very, very close to actually pinning, you know, who had done it and why and all those sorts of reasons. And whether it was actually Lee Harvey Oswald or not. What do you think, thoughts about Lee Harvey Oswald's involvement? Because he was the guy who was originally arrested for the assassination, the lone wolf, supposedly, from the Texas bookstore repository, shot Kennedy, even though Kennedy's body head actually seemed to move in the opposite direction from the bookstore. So it didn't look like the bullets had actually come from that direction. So what are your thoughts about Lee Harvey Oswald, Jason?
Well, it's an interesting one because there are some that said he was, he certainly was, there's some to say that he certainly was at one point in the employment of the mob. Some say he even worked under Jack Ruby. So it's an interesting one. Whether or not any of that is verifiable is questionable, and whether or not he still was a member of the mob at the time. There's no absolute 100% proof that he was the one that fired the gun. He was there.
He certainly was there. Had he actually fired a gun? Anyway, less speculation from us and more from the guy that did the proper investigation, the New Orleans District Attorney, Jim Garrison. And after that, we'll have a bit of John Peel music.
Lee Harvey Oswald, when he was giving out leaflets supposedly in support of Castro, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, 544 Camp Street was stamped on the literature. So this is where 544 comes into the case, through Oswald having worked there in the same building where Guy Bannister was operating.
But just to underscore the significance of what you just said, what you're describing is a situation in which ostensibly communist material has stamped on it an address 544 Camp, which is the location of part of the intelligence community in New Orleans, meaning, without a question of a doubt, there's prima facie evidence that Lee Oswald was not a communist at all. He was an agent provocateur. We later found out that on the third floor of Bannister's office, he located a small room and cleaned it out and gave it to Oswald to keep his pamphlets in. But you could see Oswald starting out in the morning and Bannister with his gruff voice and his those steel blue eyes saying, Lee, you're doing a good job. Get some more of those pamphlets out today, son. They like what you're doing in Washington. So he goes out and hands them out like he's a communist, but he's the one that calls the news people to come take the pictures, and he's acting out a role as a communist, but he doesn't know they're really fattening him up to be the turkey for Thanksgiving. He's the scapegoat. They're going to have him murdered by making him look like a communist.
Bannister was once the chief of the FBI office in Chicago. How did he first come to your attention in relationship to the assassination, Guy Bannister?
He first came to my attention, well, before the assassination, when I was district attorney, Chet Morrison, the mayor of New Orleans, said, we have a man named Bannister. Looks like he might be a good assistant superintendent of police for that vacancy. And I didn't know much about him, but I said, if he's got a good FBI background, he certainly is organized and sounds good to me. But anyway, how did he first come to my attention was when I, after spending some nights with the Warren Commission, when I I had put aside the address 544 camp to check because I saw that Lee Oswald was putting that stamp with his little rubber stamp on papers. He only did it one day and they stopped him. They kind of had a heart attack, I'm sure, but when he was putting that on the papers he was handing out to the public. But he didn't know that he was set to be the scapegoat, so he was doing what he thought was natural. But what actually happened was when he was arrested on August 9th, and brought to the first district, first thing he did was to ask to speak to an FBI agent, and the FBI agent came over, Agent Quigley, and very promptly Quigley and Oswald were locked in a private conference for some time.
This is Oswald was arrested?
Yeah, he was arrested on 9th August because of a controversy. It was a setup controversy with other Cubans. In other words, one of those things with another Cuban who at the right time said, Oswald said, hit me, Carlos, and Carlos swung at him and hit him, and then Oswald pleaded guilty. That's just to make it look like he was a troublemaker for the communists. It was all set up. And it was it resolved in those particular pamphlets becoming available to the eye, though, and ultimately available to me. So I put him on a side check, and then a few nights later, I came across in the Warren Commission report. I'm surprised nobody else found it first. I found myself reading Colonel Folsom's 201, his personnel file, 201 file of Lee Oswald and the Marines, and he casually mentioned, and here's Lee Oswald's grades in a Ryson test. And somebody must have kicked him under the table because he said he didn't do too well. He got almost as many right as he got wrong, but I wouldn't get any right in a Ryson test. With all my years in the military, and I was a major by then, I never took a Ryson test. He's a private, taking a Ryson examination. And so I realized then that there were signs of intelligence before I left the house, and intelligence training of Oswald for some nation, and this was a few, not long before, when he took this test, not long before he left for Russia. So obviously, in retrospect, he didn't leave as a communist. He left as a young Marine with an intelligence assignment, because he had, otherwise the Marines wouldn't be teaching him Russian. But I want to see what this sort of place is, Russian when this, quote, Russian studying Marine was operating out of, and that's what caused me to go down that weekend morning to Lafayette Square and look at 544 Camp Street, where I found, my God, this so-called communist, the lone assassin, the man who's supposed to have murdered John Kennedy, the man who was butchered before anybody could ask him too many questions, was an agent provocateur working for the United States government. That address, 544 Camp, was a side entrance to Guy Bannister's office. Around the corner on Lafayette Street was the entrance to Bannister's office. Across the street, where in the post office building, was an office of naval intelligence, and Bannister was naval intelligence in World War II. I knew some of these people. I knew that. And the Secret Service, as a district attorney in New Orleans, I knew where some of these places. Secret Service was also across the street. Around the corner in Lafayette, just across Lafayette Square, around the corner, was the office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And also on another floor, the office of the Central Intelligence Agency. The lone assassin, this person who's been described to all Americans and lied by other lies by the federal government to all the world as a communist, was a soldier doing his assignment, a Marine soldier doing what he was taught to do after he was given intelligence training, operating right out of the heart, the very heart of the intelligence community. The reason that the heart is located there so close to the riverfront is that's where all the ships go from New Orleans down to Central America and South America. And a lot of the members of the ship staff, as you might imagine, are intelligence men, too. Nobody was in that office who was not intelligence, Bannister's office. The time that he began operating, the week, is not specific, but it's known that it was through August that he was handing out the pamphlets. And earlier in the summer, he was working around the corner at Riley Coffee Company. Well, Mr. Riley had not necessarily involved at all, but apparently the nesting place was made available for some requests that the coffee company didn't know reason for, but request by the intelligence community for this nesting place for Oswald. He was operating out of the Ryder Coffee Company. Didn't have that much to do, so he spent most of his time at the Alba Garage next door, which happened to be the garage, and it's something else I was aware of. That was a garage for the intelligence community. It didn't even accept civilian automobiles. It was filled up with the intelligence community. So that's where he spent the earlier part of the summer, and then when August came, he was handing out the pamphlets as an agent provocateur to look like a communist, so that when Jack Kennedy was murdered by the covert action elements getting ready to kill him for the CIA, so this foreign policy could be changed back to the Cold War policy, he was being trained like a turkey being fattened for Thanksgiving.
Jim Garrison there, who's the district attorney in New Orleans. Lee Harvey Oswald being trained like a turkey for Thanksgiving. He puts it in pretty stark terms. Jason, what do you think?
Well, I'm intrigued about what's being said there. I mean, he's alluding to saying there that at the time of JFK's murder, Lee Harvey Oswald was a Marine doing his job, which largely leads to believe then, the conclusion of that is that the intelligence services wanted JFK killed, and they're the ones that did it, and it was an inside job.
Certainly seems that way. The motive really being that there was a lot of money to be made out of the various wars. I mean, we're talking about the potential invasion of Cuba, which Kennedy had just basically put on hold. There was something called the Bay of Pigs, which was a big disaster.
Bay of Pigs invasion.
Because Kennedy said, no, I'm not going to allow the US Air Force to be used to support this, basically a fake invasion run by the Americans against Castro. And I think there was a lot of resentment about that as well. So anyway, I think the main thing is, do remember Jim Garrison and Guy Bannister and what you've just heard when you hear some of the coverage in November of the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, because I think it's quite important to understand that actually the truth is out there. And I will be very interested myself to see how much of Jim Garrison's evidence is put across in November. What are your thoughts? Have a guess, Jason.
I'm guessing very little to none at all.
1993, all 10 minutes worth. Actually, we got about 9 minutes through there. That's J-A-Y-D-E-E, and a song called Plastic Dreams, first heard by me anyway on the John Peel show. Jason, we've got a bit more John Peel coming up. Have you got some news stories for us this week? Because we need to just go through the news, don't we?
Here's one for you. Boots owner accused of avoiding £1.1 billion in taxes. This is Alliance Boost. Boots, the owner of Boots, the chemist, has avoided £1.1 billion of taxes by routing its cash through a series of subsidiaries in well-known tax havens such as Luxembourg, the Cayman Islands and Gibraltar.
Boots, they are going to be added to the great long list of tax evaders. Tax avoiders. I nearly said the wrong word there.
Yeah, you've got to be careful of that, Tony.
What have they done this time?
Well, £1.1 billion of cash through subsidiaries in well-known tax havens such as Luxembourg, Cayman Islands and Gibraltar. Now, many groups such as Warren Want, Change to Win and Unite the Union have calculated that the pharmacy chain has saved the money by loading the UK business with debts from its £12.2 billion private purchase in 2007.
Oh, interesting.
And legally claiming tax relief against the interest.
Okay, so their liabilities are shifting from an offshore company into Britain. So they're going, oh, look at those nasty liabilities on our British bank account and on our balance sheet for Boots in Britain. And then, of course, that enables the profit-making offshore company to not hardly have to pay any tax at all.
Yeah, I mean, it says 40% of Boots' sales come from prescription drugs and flu jabs, and the campaigners have called on the government not to hand contracts to companies that don't pay their fair share in tax.
Good. Who are the campaigners this time? Is it UK Uncut?
Well, it is the people I mentioned there. War on Want, Change to End, and Unite the Union are among them.
Many oh, Unite the Union, War on Want, fantastic organisations. Yeah. Heroes of the modern age.
UK Uncut, I'm assuming, is among them. It does say just the campaigners, so I'm assuming it's those three. Last year, Alliance Boots sales hit £22.4 billion, with underlying profits reaching £805 million. However, the company paid just £114 million in tax, including £64 million in the UK, and up £31 million on the previous year. In the UK, under the Boots brand, sales were £6.55 billion.
Well, you're reading from the Eye there. The Independent is quite a good paper. One of the columnists on there, Owen Jones, recently was blogging and said that he thought it was wrong to call the government evil. What do you think, Jason?
Wow.
For letting people get away with this and, you know,
wow,
for all the various other
wow,
things.
Yes. I mean, it's that and stuff like Atos. You know, it's some kind of hard to avoid that word.
It is a bit. And also, I'm going to quote, I don't often quote from the Bible on this programme, but from the, there's one particular quote. Woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who continually record unjust decisions so as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of their rights. Now, what will you do in the day of punishment and in the devastation which will come from afar? Now, that's from Isaiah chapter 10. So that's all about doing bad laws, basically. And from the second book of Job, chapter 22, this is from S.K. Walker's blog. I'm not quite sure who he is, but he's kindly put these Bible quotes on there. Is not your wickedness great? Are not your sins endless? You stripped people of their clothing, leaving them naked. Well, I'm not entirely sure if that is exactly what's going on right now, but certainly figuratively, some people would say. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. Though you were a powerful man, owning land, an honoured man, living on it. Well, that's the Queen, for a start, who owns more land than the whole of England, including much land abroad. And you sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. Could anything fit the triumvirate of obscenity with which we're currently burdened? That's on the blog, not the Bible. But anyway, so there's a little quote there. That was from Job chapter 22 and also from Isaiah chapter 10. So after hearing those Bible quotes, do you think some of what said there... I mean, this is a loaded question, Jason. Do feel free to say no. I think you're talking rubbish, Tony. But evil? Is that the right word to use?
Yes.
Okay, that's simple. Thank you. Anyway, also we're going to have some more news review in a minute, but first another bit of John Peel music. But before we have that, we've got the anniversary coming up next year, haven't we, of the World War One. Now this is going to be pretty scary because there's going to be a lot of talk about, you know, was it any point to it? There's a couple of things about it I'd like to see whether they're actually going to talk about. But what are your thoughts about World War One first before I give my view?
Well, World War One was a horrible mass scale slaughter, if you will. It's I mean, it was between empires, where it's a war between empires, the Russian Empire, the German Empire, the British Empire, all started with the assassination of an Austrian prince by Serbian.
Ferdinand. Prince Ferdinand in Sarajevo.
Indeed.
And also, you were talking about the Lusitania, very important part of the beginning of the war. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because it's how the Americans entered the First World War with the sinking of Lusitania. What happened was, the Germans had previously warned the Americans, who had been talking to the British, not to send any ships into German-controlled waters. And, of course, the Americans had been talking to the British about this. And the British said, we'd love your help in the war. The Americans then did send a ship, the Lusitania, into German-controlled waters. It got shot down and, coincidentally, the Americans suddenly entered the war.
So who shot it, do we know?
It was the Germans that shot it.
Okay, so that was what caused it. Another thing I would point out is that essentially the First World War was really nothing. I mean, it was a horrendous slaughter, but it was a family squabble.
It was,
all of the leaders of the countries at the time were actually related, weren't they? They were very close family members.
Actually, it's amazing. I was doing a quiz not too long ago, and I had a picture of George V, the king of the United Kingdom at the time, the Tsar Nicholas of Russia, and Kaiser Wilhelm, and it said, "Can you tell which from which?" And I got all three of them wrong.
Right, because they actually looked the same.
Yeah, they were so identical.
So
it
was
amazing.
Like a giant family squabble. The other thing, of course, was that World War One that made the Queen change her family. Well, not the Queen, but the Queen's family changed their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor to make them sound more English. Bit of a cynical move.
I love the fact now it's Mountbatten Windsor, by the way, nowadays. It's still the House of Windsor, but the surname is now Mountbatten Windsor.
And also, I'd recommend very much anyone that's seriously interested in getting a real feel for some of the real history of the First World War is to watch Richard Attenborough's film, Oh, What a Lovely War, which was made in 1969. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No, I haven't.
Well, check it out. It was based on Charles Chilton's play. Charles Chilton's play used all sorts of trench songs, which were actually sung by the British soldiers in the trenches in the First World War, which were Mickey takes of popular songs of their day and hymns. So they would start off singing the hymn version, and then you'd slowly see the song fade into what they were actually singing in the trenches. There was also that famous incident, wasn't there, in No Man's Land?
Oh, yeah.
Which was where the Germans and the British soldiers actually, on Christmas Day, started playing football.
So are we going to see an international football match now played on the lawns of Buckingham Palace?
Yes, good idea.
Under the guidance of Prince William.
Good idea. And the only other thing to mention about that is that it happened once, I think possibly one of the first, well, if not the first winter. And then from that time on, it was strictly disallowed. So it was only one winter that happened, and once the generals found out that it had been happening, they made sure it never happened again. I mean, it's also the case that the Royal Artillery sometimes were actually dropping shells into the British trenches to force the soldiers to actually leave and go over the top and fight and probably die. But anyway, a lot of that comes across in the film Oh, What a Lovely War, and do check that out if you want. We'll have a bit more of our news review in a minute, but right now I think we're going to have a little bit more of John Peel music. This time, not the sort of thing you're probably going to hear at 2 o'clock in the morning. Something much more, should we say, poppy. And this is Stereolab from 1994 with a song about the economic crisis, if you can figure out the words, because they're sort of hidden in here. But it's a lot of wisdom about economics in this song by Stereolab called Ping Pong.
Things are
there from 1994 with a song called Ping Pong. Any economic stories this week? Sorry, I sort of jumped that one on you there, didn't I? Why don't we just, because there were some fantastic lyrics, if people were actually, because it's a jaunty little song, but it's really, really grim about the connections between the economy and war, and how the war brings around a recovery in the economic cycle. Pretty horrific song, but fantastic anyway. Poverty, Jason. One of the things I thought we might do this week is Jason and Tony on how we end poverty.
Okay.
Oh, no, it's a big question, but it doesn't. You don't often hear these things addressed on the national press, and how you do it just like that, because it's not necessarily as difficult as people make out.
Well, how would you do it then, Tony?
How would I do it? First of all, you have to wrest away control of creation of money from the private banks, because they make money out of keeping money scarce. I mean, in a way, I don't want to use necessarily biblical things too much, but, you know, you go back to the money changers in the temple. Jesus is the only time in his ministry where he got really annoyed. And, I mean, I don't know if he actually booted them out. Is that...
He overturned the tables in the temple.
Well, he ejected them anyway. I don't know if they just ran away or whether they got actually physically ejected. I'm not really sure. The idea of, I mean, creation of money is actually an incredible monopoly to have, and the private banks have got it in their little cartel in the city. The Treasury needs to really wrest away that control, and then it can spend, create money and spend it on whatever it wants. And there's no more of these stupid excuses. They say, we haven't got enough money for this, we haven't got enough money for that. Money can start then becoming the servant of society rather than society the slave to money. Anyway, any thoughts from you on how to end poverty, Jason?
Well, I was talking not too long ago to Peter Thatcher, Green Party member and gay rights campaigner, and he was saying that the really rich people, the super rich, the over rich, who dodge tax to a degree that by taxing them a really small amount, something like 1 or 2% on what they hide away from the government would be enough to wipe out national debt.
Well, that's another way to do it. Doesn't seem as if it's actually that difficult. Any thoughts on what the advantages are for some people on making sure poverty carries on? Because, I mean, maybe someone somewhere is making a lot of money at this.
I don't know.
I suppose cheap labour, maybe?
Oh, yes, cheap labour. Getting the people who are really needy to actually work for absolutely nothing, like we have now with 0-hour contracts and all that.
The more impoverished people are, the more desperate they are. I mean, one of the things, of course, that helped the Industrial Revolution along was removing people from the countryside, the enclosures, that meant that loads of people were destitute, so that they were desperate to work in the dark satanic mills, you know, the factories of the Industrial Revolution.
I can't help but notice we are sort of moving back in that general direction.
Yes, a bit scary. Okay, a bit more news review in a minute. Before that, Black Dog from Appeal Session, the song Psychosin. This is from 1999. Thank you. Dog from the 1999 Peel session Psycho Cyan. I think I said that right. And the reason you're hearing this 2 a.m. music at 11 a.m. across Bristol is because it's the John Peel show. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to get to do a John Peel show this week. Apparently, a bit too awkward for the bosses here to sort that out. But anyway, we've done it as a part of a dialect show. So that was, as I say, Black Dog. Psycho Cyan from 1999, as heard from, by me anyway, first on the John Peel show. Now, we're still on our news review too, Jason. So the Israelis have been saying that easing Iran's sanctions is like appeasing the Nazis. What do they mean by that?
Well, that particular quote was from the Minister of Strategic Affairs, Yuval Steinitz. The actual main thing came from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who suggests it'd be a historic mistake to relax the pressure on Iran now before sanctions achieve their goal.
Ah, Netanyahu, he's that guy that President Obama said, I really don't like that man, he keeps phoning up me up, he's so annoying, on microphone at the United Nations by mistake last year.
That's amazing.
The microphone was still switched on. So I think Obama finds him a little bit irritating, but he's not really supposed to be saying that in public. That's why he didn't realise the microphone was switched on. Anyway, so yeah, so what does this actually mean then for Middle East relations and the US and Britain's support?
Well, it's interesting because with the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, is more inclined to talk to the West and... I don't know how inclined he is to talk to Israel, but he's certainly more inclined to talk to the United States.
Well, Israel have got some other things to worry about right now, haven't they? Because President Assad has driven his tanks up into close to the disputed Golan Heights between Israel and Syria. So if you're not familiar with your Middle East history, check out the Golan Heights online and you'll find it's disputed territory. Syrians think it's theirs, the Israelis think it's theirs. In fact, there's not a lot of territory around Israel that they don't think is theirs, but isn't disputed.
Yeah, true.
Anyway, so yes.
Well, it is their claims that the claim of Israel is following that of the Israelite kingdoms of the Bible.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah, well, there's Ilan Ziv's film, which is all about that biblical history, which was censored by the BBC earlier this year, rather annoyingly. It was going to be on BBC4 one weekday evening, I think, at prime time, and then all that came up on the screen was, we will not be showing that documentary, we're showing something else. And he's actually an Israeli-born New York filmmaker who was basically saying that the whole idea of the Jewish exile from Palestine is a myth. Never actually happened.
Whoa, that is quite something to say, really, isn't it?
It's funny that the BBC didn't want to show that.
The BBC is being run by former Conservatives.
Yes, former Conservative chairman, in fact.
Yeah.
Lord Paton. I mean, is that allowed? The BBC,
I don't know.
Tory chairman's running the BBC. Do we want that?
Probably not. I mean...
Anyway, we've got a couple more stories. This comic, Mark Thomas, is on a blacklist. And that's it really, isn't it? So who is this comic and why is he on a blacklist? Blacklist of comics?
No, it's a blacklist of people who are working in construction. We covered this not too long ago because it came up in the Bristolian.
Okay, yes. And so is he not allowed to do his stand-up act on building sites?
No, it's just that should he ever want to, he's not allowed to work in construction. It's
But he can do his stand-up act.
Yeah, well...
Are you saying he can do his stand-up act on a building site?
Yeah, well, the thing is, you give a list of people they're not supposed to talk to as well, which is interesting.
Builders are not supposed to talk to.
I'm guessing that's kind of what I'm getting from the article here. It's... His name was found by GMB Union, which is pursuing compensation on behalf of a number of its members who also end up and other people such as environmental activists have also ended up on the list. He says, I don't work in construction industry, although I've been involved in campaigns against the activities of building firms, which is how he ended up on the list.
Amazing. All right, well, Jason, thanks ever so much for your news review. Pretty comprehensive this week, all over the world, including stand-ups on building sites. Amazing. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Tony. Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. It's your What's On Guide. It's Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 18th of October, Def Hervana will be performing with support from Charlie Simpson and Big Sixes at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £14 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Into Saturday, 19th of October, Alison Moyer will be performing at the Colston Hall in Colston Street, Bristol. Tickets range from £25 up to £45 and doors open at 7 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Blackfoot. This group formed in 1970 in Jacksonville, Florida, and are classed as Southern Rock. In their career, they have released 10 studio albums and 5 live albums. Despite numerous lineup changes, they are still performing to this day. This is the song Rattlesnake Rock and Roll, and was recorded live in 1983 at the Hollywood Palladium in LA, USA.
At 11 o'clock at night as 11 o'clock in the morning this show, I think, but anyway, Jeff, back to your What's On Guy.
Thank you. That was Blackfoot with Rattlesnake Rock and Roll, which was recorded live in 1983. For more information on the band, you can check out www.blackfootband.com. Into Sunday, 20th October, Biohazard will be performing with support from Arrhythmia, The Departed, Dead Man's Chest and Back Down at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Finally, on 20th of October, the Duval Project will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, it's a bit naughty, isn't it, using the John Peel theme for the start of his show at the end of our show. But that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks particularly to Jason Yannakopoulos, who did the news review this week, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and that number again is 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. So thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, without the John Peel theme, goodbye for now.
Pushing up the daisies, pushing up the daisies.